I'm not sure we're quite at quorum level yet, but why don't we get started? Representative Greiling. So we're going to have, this is, Representative Greiling is going to present House Bill 469. We're not going to move this bill. This is the large mental health bill. We're going to hear pieces of it in bill form a little bit later. But as an overall, to give you everybody context, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Last session, as those of you who are returning know, the legislature passed the largest investment in mental health actually in the history of our state. And for a system that's been woefully underfunded, it was an important first step, but we kind of calculate that we got about a third of the way there. So despite the deficit, to keep the issue going and to have us know that our work is not done, we have this bill. Children and adults with mental illness in Minnesota who do not receive treatment, medications, or community supports that they need end up dropping out of school, work, alienating their families, going into out-of-home placement, roaming the streets, and ending up in juvenile corrections or criminal justice system. And so there's much more we can do. And that's what this bill lays out, Mr. Chair. We must not retreat even in the face of the deficit. House File 469 is the essential next step. The bill recognizes that the different parts of our state budget are interrelated. As you know, we had the Mental Health Committee last year, which kind of did that, and this bill is going along in that same mold, but it will be broken down as into different committees, and this committee will only be doing a part of it, but I appreciate the hearing where we get the whole issue on the table. Because if you don't have access to care, increasing numbers of people with mental illness end up in our criminal justice system. If you don't provide stable housing and a job, which is my favorite part of the mental health system, people don't get better. If you don't make sure that children with mental illness are successful in school, they drop out, end up in the juvenile justice system. If we don't make sure our providers get paid for what they do, we limit access to mental health services. I just want to highlight quickly a few parts of the bill, and then we have Sue Edgar Holden from NAMI Minnesota and a couple of testifiers as well. Article 1 looks at the criminal justice system. We encourage mental health care and not a criminal justice response to a crisis, which means police training, mental health courts, and discharge planning just from people that have been in the system to stop the revolving door. Article 2 deals with youth leaving the foster care system who often have a mental illness and need continuing support and access to health insurance, and also funds the very successful ACE program in Ramsey County that targets high-risk youth. Article 3 addresses access to care by building up the number of culturally specific providers in the state, seeks to prevent suicide, adds licensed clinical counselors to the list of MA paid mental health professionals, and allows people access to care across county lines. It also ensures access to medications that treat mental illness and increases funds for the Bridges Housing Program, dual diagnosis services, and evidence-based practices that work. It also, Article 4, provides for a strong provider community by addressing a number of rate-setting issues that are necessary but not reimbursed currently, such as collateral contact with families. Article 5 is, like I said, my favorite part of the mental health system, supportive employment. It is an evidence-based practice and essential for people to recover. Article 6 is the model benefit set that was adopted last session for Minnesota health care programs, and it now would apply to state employees' health care coverage. And finally, Article 7 deals with education issues, recognizing that children who are not in school because of a symptom of their mental illness have an excused absence, that they have a high need for children in residential treatment and day treatment programs for summer school so they can catch up, allows the state school levy to be used for CIT training for school liaison officers so that they send students they're dealing with to health care instead of to the school to prison pipeline. And then lastly, the bill focuses not only on access for insurance for college, because college is a key time where young people often develop mental illness, but also to the transition needs for youth as they leave high school. And that, Mr. Chair and members, is a quick summary of the bill, and I'd like to turn it over to Sue Abderholzen, the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota.
All right, I'm just going to first call the meeting officially to order. We have a quorum. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sue Abderholzen, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and also co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. And the Mental Health Legislative Network is a coalition of over 20 organizations that advocate for a statewide mental health system that is of high quality, accessible, and has stable funding. The Mega Mental Health Bill, as Representative Greiling said, is really a way to see the interconnectedness of all the systems, criminal justice, education, employment, housing, human services, and health care. What you do in one impacts the other. One in five people will be affected by mental illness during their lifetime. It's an illness that truly affects most families, and yet it's widely misunderstood, and there continues to be a great deal of stigma surrounding it. Despite the important changes that you've made these last few years, our mental health system remains in a precarious state, and we have much work left to do. We'd really hope to pack the room, but I will say the weather has been a little bit of a barrier today. But I think you should just envision people in all of the chairs, because mental health, and I think as you've probably seen in some of the town hall meetings, comes up over and over again. At this time, I'd really like to ask Suzette Cooley, who is a parent, to come up and share her story.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me first to speak here today and talk to you about mental health services for children. My name is Suzette Peely. I'm a single parent and I have three kids. And two of my children, my sons, have special needs and mental health disabilities. I want to talk to you today about my oldest son. His name's Matt, and he knows that I speak about him. Matt has a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. That means his mood shifts from depression to mania. And when he was in elementary school, this could happen several times a day, if not within the hour. Often these mood shifts would cause Matt to display aggressive behaviors, knocking over chairs, tearing papers off walls, throwing his pencils across the room. He would frequently argue with adults. The school tried to help Matt calm down, but often these attempts were met with increased aggression. Consequently, Matt was suspended from school many times. The behavior plans and supports that the school in place did not help Matt. He was only getting worse. At home, Matt was also struggling. His mood shifted often, and simple requests to do things like do his homework or turn off his video games and eat dinner with his family would be met with defiant screaming behavior that could escalate into aggression towards his siblings, and often he would hit and strike me. Matt's sleep was erratic, and his moods were stressing out the whole family. I was at wit's end. So I contacted the Children's Social Service Unit in my county, and Matt was assigned a social worker. Matt's social worker is the one who helped us find doctors and providers. She also explained to me services available in our county and in the state, things like personal care attendants, in-home therapists, the TEFRA program, and that if Matt qualified, could provide him possibly a community-based waiver. The social worker helped me fill out the applications, and when Matt did get approved, he helped us set up PCA services. The PCAs came into our home. They were there 6 days a week for 4 to 6 hour shifts. They worked with Matt to help him learn skills. They helped me manage his behavior. Sometimes they did this when they were playing video games. Sometimes they went to the library or they went to a local park. They kept Matt busy. They redirected his behavior. They encouraged him to verbalize his frustrations instead of hitting his siblings or hitting his mom. The PCAs were able to provide the consistency that Matt needed. And having a PCA in my home not only helped Matt, it helped our family. And it helped me get just a little bit of a break from Matt's demands and from Matt's aggression. It allowed me to parent my other two children who had their own mental health needs. The alternate of Matt receiving these services like PCA support in-home therapy would have been residential treatment. And we all know residential treatment can cost 3 to 4 times more than providing home support and letting Matt stay home with his family. I'm happy to say that today, Matt is 19 years old. He's a freshman at the University of St. Thomas. He excels academically. My once young man who was failing school in sixth grade is a straight-A student on academic scholarship. He's working part-time. He's a statistics tutor. He's majoring in mathematics and computer science. He has no longer been hospitalized in at least 5 years. He's a member of the local advisory council for children's mental health in our county. Matt couldn't be here to speak to you today because he's in class right now at St. Thomas. But if he were here, he would tell you, that the reason he got better was because he had a team of individuals, including his PCAs and a social worker, and mental health professionals that supported him, and they wanted him to do well. Matt still needs support as an adult. He no longer needs PCAs, but he does have an ARMS worker who meets with him weekly and helps him with independent living skills. He has a vocational rehab counselor to help him with employment and post-secondary education. He doesn't have a driver's license. He isn't ready to move out of the house, but that's okay. Matt's doing well. I'm proud of Matt. And what I'm asking you today is to not cut mental health services, not to take away PCA supports out of the budget and away from kids who have mental illness. Keep the level of services for our children at least at the current levels. Doesn't every child, I ask you, like Matt, deserve a chance to get well and to succeed? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Billy Dinkle. I run a small nonprofit chamber of commerce in the White Bear Lake area. I'm here on a personal note today to talk a little bit about myself and about my situation. Hopefully to put a face on depression that maybe is a little different than you normally see. If you look around this room or you look around even this committee, there are probably people on this committee who suffer from depression and are afraid to talk about it, afraid to even sometimes tell their families about it. But those people with proper help and proper treatment and maybe even proper care can be successful parts of society, as proved by them being maybe in this committee or in this gallery. Myself, I feel like I've come through a lot and have become fairly successful at what I do, and that's running our nonprofit business association. I have suffered from dysthymia and major bouts of depression since I was 15. Was a pretty, I guess you'd say an all-American kid. I grew up on a farm, worked hard, was all-conference in four sports, got A-minuses in high school, went on to college. Started suffering from depression when I was 16 or 17 years old and was diagnosed with dysthymia and had major bouts of depression. The problem I think that I faced wasn't that there wasn't treatment, wasn't that there wasn't avenues for me to get better or to find medication or to live my life normally. There's a stigma that goes along with depression that is unbelievable. I don't know how lepers felt in the old days, but I'm assuming they felt a little bit like when you tell someone that you have depression or you suffer from depression. Quite frankly, it took a lot for me to come here today because I'm a conservative guy. I have conservative political beliefs, and I know that I'll probably have some ramifications from some of my conservative counterparts and colleagues in my industry. But there are people in this world who don't need to be locked up because they're suicidal. They just need a little help. And I'm not here to tell you about to vote for this bill or to drastically increase spending or to cut spending or either way. I'm just here to put a face on depression that maybe doesn't look the same as you think about when you see depression in your mind. I was in a situation a few years ago, actually, where my employer told me that when I notified my employee of why I had been missed a couple days from work because I literally couldn't get out of bed and we were adjusting my medication, that I should never talk about this at work again, stay away from me, and don't bring this up at work ever again. There is a stigma that goes beyond stigma and almost to a, I don't want to say that it's, I don't want to treat it like a, I mean, it's a disability. It's almost like people are ashamed to be around, like it's contagious. Like if I rub up against you, like you're going to get depressed or something. And what employers sometimes don't understand is that It costs people a lot of money. It costs employers millions and millions and sometimes billions of dollars. Our economy, depression costs our economy billions of dollars. And with a little bit of a positive environment or a little bit of an outreach, maybe a handout or a hand up or a little bit of help or the proper treatment or just a little bit of patience with whether a person can get the right medication at the right time, the benefits far outweigh getting rid of that person and finding a new employee and retraining that employee. And I think it's been my experience with the business community, sometimes has a problem with that. And I'm really here today to just kind of tell my story and maybe put a little different face on that and hopefully it will inspire some of you or some of you in the gallery to think twice about how you think about depression and the stereotypes you think of when you think of a depressed person. It's not always the person that needs to be locked up for 4 days, for 10 days, for 30 days, because they're going to split the risk. That's not the majority of the depressed people in the world. The majority of the people in our communities that need help with depression just need a few days here and there to maybe get their medication right, or maybe someone to talk to, or you know, the old mental health day. There's no such thing as just kidding when we say that we need a mental health day off of work. It's true. That you do sometimes, you know. I'm finishing up here, but you know, keep in mind that normal is just a basket full of unique, and if we can make sure that we treat each individual uniquely, and maybe we can help some people be productive parts of society. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think you have the breakout bills now, but that's
all right.
The end of...
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And thanks for all your work on this. I think we're going to start with Representative Mueller. Is Representative Mueller here?
He's in the basement.
He's in the basement. Okay, we don't have to do that then right away. Representative Loeffler? No. Sure. Yeah, why don't we do that? And Representative Bond, will you move the minutes from the February 25th meeting?
Gladly, Chair Heaton, I move the minutes from the February 25th meeting.
Any discussion? All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. All right. Representative Loeffler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 934 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Division, or Finance Committee, I guess, is the official best.
To the Finance Culture. Committee, correct. All right, to your bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I do have an A1 amendment to get the bill in the proper form. What the A1 amendment does is provide for transition coverage while we're waiting for federal approval for the plan amendment. Mm-hmm. And I would like to move that.
Okay. Does everybody see the amendment? Any discussion? All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And that motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 934 takes advantage of a federal medical assistance option that allows MA coverage to be extended for children who are aging out of foster care. Once a child turns 18, they are no longer eligible for publicly paid foster care, and this would allow that they would have health coverage until their 21st birthday. And it would require us to amend our state medical assistance plan. And that's why the amendment would allow for state-paid medical assistance until that's granted. But it is currently an option under the Federal Medical Assistance Program. It's hard for me to imagine most 18-year-olds being ready to move out and take charge of their life, find housing, work, deal with all the issues of life, whether it's health insurance or whether it's more minor things like how to find a set of wheels, at age 18. And yet we every year have about 600 children throughout the state of Minnesota who are in that situation. And
how many?
I'm sorry. 600.
Okay.
And that isn't because there hasn't been a good faith effort on the part of counties and social service agencies throughout the state to find adoptive families for these children. But many of them have gone through very traumatic experiences in their life. Some of them have been abandoned by families. Some of them have had family members who have had very serious issues they've had to struggle with. And others have just been left behind because of the death in the family that happened at an untimely point in their life. Many of them, like many children who have had challenges and those who haven't, as we heard from the eloquent testifier earlier, have run into issues with mental health, but not necessarily the majority of them, but continued medication will be a component of their success as they leave the system and try and forge an adult life. And I think that we as a state are really sort of their surrogate parents when we take on that foster care responsibility when there's no one else in their life. We passed earlier legislation that allows children with parents to be covered under their parents' insurance policy up to age 25 if they're dependent. I think it's only fair that we should allow these children, for whom we are as a state responsible for them, to extend health insurance to age 21. I looked over the lunch hour at the Hennepin County website where they have a waiting children's list where they have 46 children who are looking for placement in a permanent adoptive home. And it is heart-wrenching, the stories and the hopes and dreams that they share there. And they break many of the stereotypes that people have. I mean, there are children who are doing exceedingly well in school, who dream of becoming physicians, and one wanted to be a psychiatrist, and they really have interesting lives and hopes and dreams. But at 18, it's pretty hard to implement that all on your own. And I wanted to just share a quote from a 16-year-old who's hoping to be adopted. He's described as an extraordinary young man with many talents. He said he would prefer other children in the home, close in age, but other children are not a requirement. He said, "It's nice to have someone to talk to and stuff. It gets pretty boring when you're by yourself all the time." And I can't imagine someone trying to launch their adult life at 18 without the safety net of a family or other caring and trusted adults to step them forward. This will at least give them a chance to continue on with a health care provider who may have been part of the successful transition from whatever occurred in their life to put them in a situation to hopefully becoming successful adults. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mayor Reagan to testify further.
Welcome, Ms. Reagan.
Thank you. My name is Mary Reagan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies.
And we have about 5 minutes more.
Okay. Which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. Many of the young people that we're talking about age out of our foster care providers' homes. Essentially, this bill would smooth the way for kids to get medical assistance coverage. Most of them are going to be eligible, but like most 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they don't necessarily do a good job of following through with filling out applications. They may move, and they may not leave a forwarding address, so they may get dropped off the rolls. This basically just ensures that they're covered and prevents them from being part of the cohort that ends up in the emergency room because they have nowhere else to go, they have no ongoing health care, and they have no health insurance. So it's preventative, and it's been done by over 50% of the state since this was allowed beginning in 1999.
Any questions, members? Not in this committee. There will be a fiscal note, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, thanks for bringing this forward. I realize this isn't a finance committee, and so I'll try to keep my questions to the point about this. But we just talked in the previous committee about the need to get people involved in private health care coverage, to do things for them up front, to keep them independent, to provide portability. And here we're talking about putting more people into medical assistance. From a policy perspective, it's a matter of, are we going to give people private care options, or are we going to move them into more public coverage options? And the danger there being that in many cases these systems are becoming unsustainable. So we make a promise that we end up not being able to keep. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I don't know that any 18-year-old is ready to navigate our private market if we were to give them a financial voucher. And I think continuity of care, particularly for children for whom there has been trauma and there has been a relationship perhaps with a mental health provider or other health care provider, to be able to continue that till age 21. It's what we allow for children who have families and who have private coverage, that they're allowed to be continued under their parents' policy and have that continuation as they launch into adulthood. And so I think it's just treating these children the way we would children who are lucky enough to have parents who have private insurance. Hopefully they will be able to secure employment with health insurance, but many of them expect to be and hopefully are in higher education during the years that we're covering this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Wofford, there are a number of 18-year-olds who work and even get health coverage through employment. The point is there are other ways of providing coverage besides medical assistance, and we'll be discussing some of them, I think, this session, but I think the question was more to, is there a concern that using medical assistance as the means of covering these people is unsustainable and therefore a promise we can't keep? That was really my question.
Mr. Chairman and members, I would just once again remind you that this is only 600 children statewide, and I think we'll see with the fiscal note that, I mean, children of this age tend to be fairly affordable. I don't know that this is going to be a major cost. The cost of not assuring coverage is, as Ms. Regan said, is emergency room use, falling off of medications that keep their life stable that may allow them to be successful in a post-secondary institution. I think there's societal cost if we don't have that continuity.
Ms. Regan.
I would just make the point, because I think that's an important question, but if they were lucky enough to secure private insurance, Medicaid is always the payer of last resort, so their private insurance would cover their health care, and Medicaid wouldn't be used for that.
Thank you, Mr. Thiessen. Actually, thank you for hitting on the points I was going to dovetail on there, but just to be very clear, first of all, is it the correct assumption that the 600 currently are on MA when they're in foster care? So it's one mechanism for continuing the same set of providers. And in my experience, and I've had some contact with foster care teenagers, a lot, very high percentage are on getting psychological services or on medications for psychological needs for periods of time, lengths of time. So first of all, is that true? And so this helps continue. But secondly, I also had the same question about if they went right into the workforce, would we be inquiring about insurance provided by the employer and then just filling in the gap between the employer and what they're able to pay? And I would hope that we'd be doing that. It sounds like so if you can just confirm the answers to those questions.
All children in out-of-home placement are eligible for medical assistance. So, yes, they all would be receiving medical assistance. And as the payer of last resort, it would always be secondary.
Well, and we should, just to clarify that, so you'd be secondary in the sense that you wouldn't be filling the gap between, we wouldn't be filling the gap between what could be afforded and you wouldn't cover the out-of-pocket costs for the kid. They would have insurance at work, and then if that insurance wasn't covering something, then it would fall back to Medicaid. I think there's two different questions asked there.
Representative Bunn.
Let's follow up on that. Yeah, I do think we're not quite clear yet. The situation where there are low-income people who are offered insurance to an employer, we hear this all the time with nursing homes and other areas, who turn it down because they can't afford their portion of it. How does that fit in with this? And it's not like it's the last resort because they don't have the other insurance. Is there a way to take advantage of the other insurance but then pay, fill in some way so that they can afford the insurance? It sounds like we may not have a mechanism to do that right now.
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, we do have currently in our medical assistance program, and it's an eligibility review item where they always ask if you have access to any other insurance. It's called cost-effective coverage, and it is where it is cost-effective for medical assistance to supplement rather than cover the full cost, and it's used in a variety of circumstances. I don't remember all the details, but there is a provision in our current medical assistance program that looks at that.
Okay, members, we need to wrap this up. We've got a lot of other bills to hear. So if there are no other questions, we're going to move to a vote on this. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 934, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. The bill is passed. Thank you. Okay, Representative Mullery. Hey, welcome to the committee, Representative Mullery. Representative Mullery, I'm going to move your bill, House File 449, that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. And Representative Mullery, we only have about 10 minutes to hear this bill, so we're going to try to move through this as quickly as we can. So welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the first thing would be I request you also to move the A1 amendment to get it in the form of the budget.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment to get it in the form that the author would like. Does everybody have the A1 amendment? Members, any questions on the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing no questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's been a lot of studies that show that law enforcement are not trained to deal with people who have mental issues. And in many cases, in fact, the president of the Minneapolis Police Federation told me that they get training, which they've now found out works with most people, but it does the exact opposite with people suffering from certain types of mental illness. And he wanted to put on record that he and the federation very strongly support this bill. What it does, it will provide training. It's called crisis intervention team training for law enforcement. It's a system that was set up originally in Memphis and now has spread around the country as by far the best system for training law enforcement. We've had many instances, even in Minneapolis and around the state, where sometimes the law enforcement is harmed, but usually it ends up with the person with the mental illness being either severely harmed or even killed by law enforcement, which is very unfortunate and which they understand is really a huge problem for them because they're not trained on dealing with it. And so what we're trying to do is get money to have the training for more people in law enforcement around the state so that when police react to these emergency situations, they will how to recognize that the person may have a mental illness and should be treated differently and then to treat them differently. And so today we have Sue Abderholden here as a witness. She's the head of NAMI in Minnesota.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. Just briefly, the CIT training really is the best that there is in the country. We've trained a number of officers in Minnesota. This last year, the Department of Human Services actually had grants to give out to communities where both the mental health and the police community came together and said they'll work together and get the training, which is why we moved it to the Department of Human Services. It benefits everyone. It benefits the police officers. They have reduced workers' comp claims. It benefits the individuals with mental illness, and it really is a way to divert people from the criminal justice system. So I would urge your support for the bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Angle.
Madam Chair, while I said that the Police Federation supports it, I also would like to say that he went a lot further than that. He said it's the most important training they can have.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Members, any questions on this bill? Representative Bunce.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Mullery, or to the testifier, how many it's a 40-hour training, which is a pretty expensive waste of time. It's not a huge amount of money that you have mentioned here, at least in the bill summary. That was obviously not the purview of our committee, but I'm just wondering how many officers do you expect to, how many departments and then how many individual officers are you expecting to be able to train for this amount?
Representative Mullery or
Representative Brett.
What the department has done is ask for kind of a local match as well. The 40 hours is, you know, it is extensive, but it is really good, and they really do prevent a lot of injuries and things like that. So it kind of varies on what the local folks can put up with as a match. So it's kind of hard to say exactly how many, but the Department of Human Services will stretch the dollars as far as they can and maybe look at some federal block grant dollars as well.
Madam Chair, and Representative Bunn in the other committee, it was also pointed out by the officer who does it for Minneapolis that it depends on where it is. If it's in a very hard-to-get-to location, then they have to pay for the trainers and to come up there and stay. They have to pay the transportation. They have to often pay. Sometimes there's a split on the law enforcement on how that's paid. When it's in the metro area, it's much, much, much cheaper to get each per law enforcement order officer trained.
Okay, very quickly, Representative Bunn, and then we have another
question. Well, just a follow-up comment is that I understand the complexity that you described, trying to get a grip on that number of people that might be trained, but and I understand that you want the best quality training, but particularly in times like this where it's going to be hard to get matching funds or even initial funds and all those kinds of things, it seems like, you know, doing it remotely via teleconferencing seminars, one location, have them all plug in at one statewide. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of other options here. And also that even though it might be the best quality train, in the end, it only matters if they actually get the train. And so if the issue of the time, a lot of it might need to be adjusted so that at least more people can have some training. So I'm just raising those questions, and I'll stop with that. You don't necessarily need to respond.
Okay, and there is another question from Representative Norton. Okay. All right. Well, she passed. Somebody wanted to
mention that. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that a huge part of this training is actually doing the kind of the role playing, so that you really figure out how to do it. And to be honest, if we couldn't do the full CIT training, I'd say just don't bother. There's lots of organizations that will do Mental Illness 101 and, you know, a 2 hour so you kind of understand what it is. But if we're going to spend any money on police training, I'd really want it to be CIT. It's the most effective.
Okay, thank you very much. And I will renew the motion that House File 449 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Bill is passed. Thank you very much.
Mallory bill.
Okay, Representative Mallory, we have your other bill. Representative Mallory moves that House File 448 be recommended to pass, referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor, with a recommended re-referral to the Telecommunications Regulation and Infrastructure Division. Okay, that's what you're expecting, Representative Mueller?
No, Madam Chair, we didn't know that one.
Okay, I guess apparently they requested
it. The last one we knew went to finance, but this one we were told was going to the floor, but apparently not.
Okay, no, I guess not. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, or Madam Chair, and if you would, if somebody would move a real simple oral amendment, which is just to delete Section 2.
Okay, Representative, I'll move that Section 2 of the bill be deleted. Let me get that copy of it. Okay. All right, any discussion on that, members? Okay, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the amendment is adopted. Please proceed and explain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one is really simple. Basically, it just says that the 9/11 system can include referral to mental health crisis teams if they're available. And it just seems natural that why would we not want the 9/11 operators and the system to be able to, if they recognize that there's an issue where a crisis team could be available, that they can have them come in. But Ms. Aberholden can explain it further.
Madam Chair, members, as you know, in 2007, you provided funding for mental health crisis teams in Greater Minnesota. You had before had them in the metro area. And in the Grand Rapids area, for example, their 911 system, while they may dispatch a police officer if they believe it's a mental health crisis, they also dispatch the mental health crisis team, who can then stay there, stabilize the person, figure out what needs to be done with them, and the police officer can leave, which really frees up their time a great deal. And so now that they are being developed around the state, we just want to make sure that they're tied in. So this just gives permission. It doesn't require that they do that. But in those communities, you know, the 911 folks can work with the mental health crisis teams, and if it's going to work in their community, this allows them to do that. We had heard from some that said, well, we can't because they're not specifically mentioned, even though Grand Rapids was stated and did it. So we're just kind of clarifying.
Okay, thank you. Members, questions, Representative? Let's start with Representative Norton, then we'll go to Bob.
Thank you. I'm not that familiar with the mental health crisis teams, and so I'm wondering under what kind of authority, either legal or what have you, what's their, how are they founded and what's their authority?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm looking over at Mr. Tekel. A lot of them, they're grants from the state, plus they can bill for Medicaid. So a lot of them are out of the mental health centers or a mental health care provider. There are regulations in Medicaid, you know, for things that they have to have in terms of mental health professionals and things like that. So it isn't just someone hanging out a shingle saying, I'll provide mental health crisis services. They have to be a real entity that's recognized under Medicaid, too.
And if I could...
Representative Norton.
Thank you. And that's kind of what I'm getting at. I mean, when 911 generally calls, they're calling a county, an authorized sheriff, could be city if it's police. And then the mental health crisis team, I'm wondering if that's, you know, under whose authority is that? Is it a county agency, county supported? I'm just a little concerned with that. And also, and I know we're not a finance committee, but the funding implications that might go along with that as well. Are these people paid? Are they voluntary by calling them? Is it billing MA? Is it county bill?
Madam Chair, there wouldn't be a fiscal note because they already exist. And, you know, we would hope that they would be used, frankly, more frequently than they already are, because we really do reduce hospitalizations. We reduce people going into jails because of them. So they're already an entity out there. What we want is, you know, for where it's appropriate, so where the 911 system has, you know, contact with the crisis team, they know them, they know how they work as in Grand Rapids, and to make those referrals.
Representative Norton, follow-up.
Well, yeah, I'm still not exactly clear about the system here, and also you say they're already being funded. Are they on 24-hour calls so that if you call them in the middle of the night, whatever pay they're getting because they're an entity, it's just part of their salary?
Ms. Atherholt.
Ma'am, so they already are required to be 24/7. They are either county operated or county contracted. So, you know, there's a legitimacy involved there. And they're already 24/7. So, frankly, the more that they get used, the better, because we don't pay for the downtime either.
Okay.
Madam Chair, regards to the fiscal, I did ask Gary Carger from our fiscal staff, and he indicated there was no fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mallory. Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is very brief. It kind of relates to the issue of authority and legality issues and also liability issues. You mentioned that currently, you know, the police or the sheriff would be called out to check on the situation. With the addition of the mental health crisis team, would the police and sheriff still be legally required to also go but then can leave earlier?
Ms. Appleton?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Just to kind of follow up a little bit more on Representative Norton's question. So does they're Medicaid funded, the teams, but do they bill for specific time?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, so first they get funding from the state through the grants that you appropriated in 2007 because that helps pay for, frankly, their downtime. They can bill private insurance, they can bill Medicaid, they can bill Minnesota Care, General Assistance Medical Care. So they're, you know, they're an entity that can take both public and private health care funds.
So then to follow up on Representative Norton's question, so if we are using them more, arguably we're going to have a Medicaid impact. That, I think, is a fiscal question we were getting after, because we fund them with our state grants, but then if they bill back against Medicaid and we're increasing utilization, I'm not saying that's
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Houston, I mean, they bill now for Medicaid, you know, and other private, insurers as well. And any time, frankly, that you get a crisis team coming out, we have data that shows that you actually can oftentimes prevent a hospitalization. So if you have someone on Medicaid where you can get the crisis team to stabilize them, you've just saved a lot of money in the emergency room and then possible hospitalization. So I think it's a hard, I think it's a hard one to know, you know, exactly, is this going to mean there's going to be 20 more people or 50 more people served by the crisis team? You know, but I think what we do know is that crisis teams prevent people from using some of the other services.
And Madam Chair, I don't, I don't disagree with anything you just said, but I think for budgeting purposes, I don't know if there's going to, maybe we get savings actually from this. I'm just, it's just, I just want to be clear that it's not just that we give them grants, but they can also bill back against Medicaid. So if they're treating someone that's on Medicaid, there is a cost to the state that would show. Maybe it's savings because we're not paying for more expensive care, but am I right just about that piece of it?
Ms. Abderholzen.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, also the more that people hear about them, you know, the more that people, I would hope that people would call the crisis team directly, which is something that we've actually been working on, making sure that families, as they develop a crisis plan, know that those teams exist instead of showing up in the emergency room. When someone has a mental health crisis, they have to go somewhere. So, you know, yes, we could have savings from this. I kind of doubt, frankly, that there would be increased costs because, again, they have to go somewhere if they're having a mental health crisis.
Okay.
Okay. Question from Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the taxpayer, in the example where this is already in practice, have the 9/11, folks that work for 9/11, are they trained? Is there training involved in this? So as this rolls out, will the people who are receiving the emergency calls know when or when not to call the crisis team, and how does that happen?
Ms. Abderholz.
Madam Chair, Representative, what happened in Grand Rapids is they all came together to figure out how to make this work. They had a hospital closure, and so they wanted to figure out what happens when someone has a crisis. And so they've worked that out in their community. And I believe that the local crisis team are the ones that worked with the 911 operators to help them decide which things. And the police and sheriff know what to do. If they show up and see that it's a mental health crisis, they also call the team to try to, you know, have it resolved in that way instead of bringing the person to the emergency room or hospital or jail.
Anything else, Representative Murphy?
So just one follow-up to that. You know, the legislation that we just looked at about the crisis intervention team is talking about making sure that law enforcement gets the training they need to intervene more properly. So as I think about that and then move over here, it seems like training would be an important part of this as it moves forward. And I would just suggest as you move forward with the legislation that you might contemplate that as a part of the legislation.
Okay, thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Bond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, I'm trying to learn how this works. If it was the crisis intervention team was called by the 911 operator to a household where the individual is a private insured person, not on but they didn't request that kind of intervention. In fact, even maybe someone else made the call. but they get sent the bill for it. Since it sounds like their insurance will be billed. Is that legal for it to be billed for insurance for something that you didn't request and maybe even denied that you wanted? I'm just curious how that funding works.
Madam Chair, Representative Bond, if they never actually provided service but came and then had to leave, I don't see how they could bill for a service they didn't provide. You know, we have, paramedics who show up and then, you know, don't do anything and leave, and I don't believe they bill, because you can bill insurance for that too, and I don't believe they do, you know, they bill just because they showed up at your house and then left. So I think it would be a very similar situation. Not all private insurance companies pay for crisis teams, but especially the Minnesota-based ones, you know, are more and more are doing that because they see it as a real benefit in terms of reduced costs for hospitalization in the emergency rooms.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Bond.
Well, I does that mean that at the point when they arrive, there's some sort of exchange? This is assuming the person's in a state where they're able to do this exchange, where they say, you know, we would like to stay with you and do X, Y, and Z, and the person agrees to that, and the person is told that this would mean there would be some insurance claim about it? Or it just happens?
Madam Chair, Representative Bond, I don't know the answer to that, but I will get that for you.
All right. Representative Kelly, were you looking to be recognized? No. Okay, well, I do have a question. Ms. Abderholden, as I'm looking at the bill, it looks to me like all you're doing here is changing shall to must, and I'm not sure what the effect of
that's just the revisor.
And then what we've got is the this one sentence that just says that the 9/11 system may include a referral. And my question is, are they now not allowed to make a referral? Is that the issue here, Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, that's what some were saying in the community, so we wanted to just make it clear that you could, if it was available and that kind of worked in your area, that you could do that.
Okay, so all you're really doing here is clarifying that they may make a referral where it's available. So as I'm seeing it, we're having this whole discussion, but the effect of the bill itself really doesn't seem that momentous to me.
I guess I would agree.
All right. Other questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that you did ask that, I guess I would have a comment just on the vagueness of it, because as Representative Thiessen said, if there's a propensity to just automatically call the service, if someone's going to get billed, whether it's from Medicaid or, as Representative Bunn just brought up, to a private insured, I'm a little concerned that just becomes an issue that they're automatically called out, because really isn't an ambulance is called or an emergency 911. That seems like a crisis that could really fall under a mental health crisis just in about any situation. So I guess that's all my comment. Thank you.
Ms. Abderholden, did you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would just say that we work a lot with the EMS folks, and they say they don't have the training very much to really deal with mental health crises. And they actually have been looking to us to help them to do some training. So they don't feel like they're in a great place to do it. And that's why we really developed these mental health crisis teams, because it is something that's a little bit different. You know, I'll find out about what happens if they show up and how that billing and stuff takes place. That's kind of the detail that I just don't know. I'm a little, 500 feet above that, but I will find that out.
Okay. Members, if there's no other questions, Representative Mueller, you want to close up here?
Well, just, I was going to point out that every time there's a call of police or anything, whether it's necessary or not, we pay for it, so I'm not sure that it's different.
Madam Chair, I think the point
Representative
is we pay for it with tax dollars. What Representative Bunn is saying is if you have a copay, and someone is forcing you to pay a copay for someone showing up on your private insurance, that's a little bit different issue, I think, and we don't know what's going on.
Okay, we'll find out. All right, I will renew
a charge.
Okay.
Yeah, for police coming out.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm going to renew the motion that House File 448 be recommended passed, referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor with a recommended re-referral to the Telecommunications Regulation and Infrastructure Division, and I forgot to say House File 448 as amended. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Mueller.
Hayden.
Okay, Representative Hayden, you're up. Okay, welcome to the committee, Representative Hayden.
Thank you so much. I've always wanted to know how it was to sit in this seat here.
And so, that
was wonderful from his vantage point.
First bill hearing. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And Representative Hayden, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 985 to pass and move to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Representative Hayden moves that House File 985 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Hayden, if you'd like to explain your bill.
Thank you. First of all, this is part of the Youth Moving Forward / Ready to Launch initiative supported by a broad coalition of advocates and providers working on behalf of youth. This bill would allow youth who age out of care or who run from care after age 15 to come back to youth-serving social service system for help if they need it. This option is currently only available to wards of the state. So it's very similar to Representative Loeffler's bill. However, it deals much more with the services. Each year in Minnesota, approximately 600 youth prepare to leave home for good because these youth have been removed from their families and have not been given permanent families. Turning 18 means they are truly on their own. Foster youth are no more ready for independence at age 18 than their non-foster care peers. 95% of Americans are 95% of Americans 25 or older. Let me repeat that. 95% of Americans are 25 or older before they are able to live self-sufficiently on their own. Less than 10% of 18-year-olds live on their own. Recent estimates suggest that parents provide their young adult children with material assistance totaling approximately $38,000 after they reach 18. Parent time assisting their 18 to 34-year-old children averaged 367 hours per year. This is 9 weeks of full-time help. Also, 61% of college students receive financial support from their parents. These are our young people for whom we've accepted responsibility by removing them from their parents and placing them in care. We need to provide what all good parents provide, a place for them to return for help when things go wrong or unexpected supports go away. Just on a more personal note, I have a foster care house that provides foster care in my block. We share an alley from the next block over. And frequently I have young folks that have aged out of that foster house to come over and ask for, you know, small jobs, raking and shoveling. And if those aren't available, just asking for money just to kind of make it each and every day. As a matter of fact, just last Saturday at about 9 o'clock, one of the young men came over and rung the doorbell to kind of alarm my family. It was pretty late. But basically was looking for just some money so that he can eat each and every evening. So it is something that not only I think is important, but it is happening each and every day. And just the caveat to that, I asked the young man, you know, I gave him a couple of dollars and asked him, you know, what did he plan to do? And he said he really didn't know. He didn't have a family, and that he would do whatever he needed to do to survive. And I'm not quite sure what that meant, but that troubled me. I'd like to turn it over to Mary Regan to also continue the testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the state.
Thank you. My name is Mary Regan. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. And as you heard from Representative Hayden, this is one of several bills that fall under the Youth Moving Forward and last year called Ready to Launch Initiative. About a year and a half ago, we pulled together all kinds of folks from counties, from the state, from provider organizations. We talked to youth who had aged out of care, and we tried to examine and identify what would be most helpful to help these kids succeed once they left. These are children we've invested a lot of money in. We've invested a lot of time, but we've also invested a lot of money, and the outcomes are not great. So we really tried to take a look at what would help. And last year, you passed a bill that put into place a whole set of criteria that the courts need to look at and hold the child, the provider, and the worker accountable for in terms of planning to age out of care and get the independent living skills they need and get things in place so that they'll be successful. These next two pieces are things that were identified as critical. And this one is really backup. It's what our kids get when at 19 and the roommate moves out and they can't afford the house all by themselves or the apartment all by themselves, and they call us and we strategize with them. That's what we're talking about here. And I really don't think that every child who ages out of the system is going to turn around and come back to county social services. I think it'll be a few children who are very desperate and really, really need help. And I think it's an important way we can prevent homelessness, we can prevent crime, we can prevent them from being victims, which is often what happens. They're either victims or victimizers if they have to do whatever it takes to survive. And this is a better option.
Okay, any questions, members? Representative
Thanks, Representative Hayden. I just can't let you not have a question, at least if you're going to have your first bill up here. But,
absolutely.
I actually have a real question anyway, so it looks to me like this is just a development of a plan, right? It doesn't have to have money tied to it, but it has just some, it just would kind of take all the, whatever they're eligible for anyway, and makes it kind of logically aligned. Is that true? There's no fiscal note to this bill. Is it necessary?
Representative
Hayden? So I've got two questions. So that's my two questions.
Well, first of all, yes, I think that it would just allow the county social service to develop a system, and that could be social workers that they have there or other agencies that they're working with in order to develop a system to talk about what were their needs and maybe help them navigate the system, if you will, or become eligible. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll defer to Mr. Regan about the fiscal note.
Ms. Regan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there would be no fiscal note in terms of state appropriation, but depending on what the child needed and what the county decided to provide, there might be a county cost.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Abler.
So, I mean, and I guess I figured that, kind of get my arms, because I thought it was a good idea to help some of these folks not fly a cooperative, but it looks to me like it's kind of existing. They're eligible anyway, and this just gets them back into the consultation phase, or does this open up a new stream of benefits that wouldn't have been there?
Ms. Reed.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, right now the folks that are clearly eligible for this are wards of the state. Not all of these children are wards of the state. So what we would be doing is expanding this opportunity to kids who age out or who run away after 15. So it does expand the possibility of other youth to come back and ask for help.
And the county can then decide what it's capable of doing, and if they're like broke, then they would just talk to them and say good luck, or would they have a discreet duty for them to do something more?
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I do think that the language in the bill suggests that they need to have a plan and that they need to, it says, ensure that any foster care, housing, or counseling benefits are tied to that plan. So I do think that there's an expectation that they would provide what that child needed as part of the plan that they developed.
And Madam Chair, I'm just back on, but
a little bit more, Representative Abler. Yeah. We've got a couple more questions here.
Yeah, I know. But I just kind of see it as a low bar, because it says anything you're doing has to be consistent with the plan. I think the plan is the big thing here. I'm just, maybe I'm speaking kind of in favor of it, but thank you.
Okay, we've got Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, and Director Regan. Do you have an estimate as to how many children across the state of Minnesota will be served by this program?
Madam Chair, Representative, well, there are an average of 600 kids who age out of care every year. I don't know that we have a good sense of how many of them would actually come back and ask for help, but I suspect that the department is trying to figure that out if they put together a local impact fiscal note.
Representative Ferguson, anything else? Okay, thank you, Representative
Keeson. Thanks. So just so I understand this better. So if you're in foster care, you get one of these plans. Mm-hmm. The kids in foster care get a plan like this, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, and then this interacts with Representative Loftus' bill that one of the benefits could be, if both were to pass, one of the coordinated, I guess these are unrelated bills in some sense, or is there a connection between the getting people access to medical assistance that would be part of this plan?
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair, Representative Tyson, I think they're connected because we're talking about the same children and we're talking about two different ways in which we can provide support. I don't, at this point, I'm not sure that any of I suppose counseling benefits might be one. If they're covered by medical assistance and they need counseling and the caseworker helped them get a therapist, for example, then Medicaid would likely pay for that. So
I think. And one other question. What about, going back to Representative Loffler's bill, people that were discharged from foster care on runaway status after age 15, her bill's not making those folks eligible for Medicaid, right? I'm just wondering if there's a disconnect there and we need to kind of, maybe we should have taken the other one first, but do you know what I mean? Because we're not making the same exception.
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think you're right. I don't think we are including those kids who ran away after 15 in Representative Loffler's bill at this point, but we'd certainly be open to doing that if you thought that was a good idea.
Anything else, Representative
Thiessen? No.
Or Representative Loffler, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's something we can look into further. I think they probably would be eligible, but there's an emancipation of minors process, and I'm not sure about how you do it, but I suspect that 15-year-old runaway whose parents have not taken any responsibility, if you had a child with a need, the system will respond in one way or another.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
just so I understand this, under Representative Loffler's bill, you have to actually be in foster care when you're 18 to qualify, and the discharge would be someone who is in foster care but leave foster care before they're 18 because they ran away. Right? And so, is that Ms. Aides? Okay, so there's a little bit of a gap there. Okay.
Ms. Aides, you want to?
Yes. Madam Chair, Ms. Representative Thiessen, in Representative Loffler's bill, it requires them to be in custody and for either the county or the commissioner to have financial responsibility. If they've run away after age 15, they may still be in the custody. Probably not, but they might be, but they don't have financial responsibility for them anymore. So, no, they would not be eligible for medical assistance if they were on runaway status.
Categorically. Okay.
All right. Other members? Representative Kelly?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if Director sees that as any as problematic at all. If are we creating maybe an incentive for those 15-year-olds to, if they can receive benefits? I assume we want to keep them in foster care as long as they're eligible to be. So do you see that problematic as well as offering benefits if they're runaway?
Ms. Regan.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think if they're unhappy enough in their living arrangement to run away at 15, that it would be unlikely that the long-term impact at 18 is something they would think about. I think what our real hope is that these are particularly vulnerable kids. These are the kids that are homeless and have been for years and are couch hopping, and what I think we're hoping is that this would be an opportunity to sort of get back in and get straightened out and turn things around.
Okay, members, if there are no other questions, I think we can move to a vote on this bill. I'm not seeing any other questions. So Representative Hayden renews his motion that House File 985 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Root.
Representative Hayden, are you aware that if it's your first bill, you're supposed to bring treats to the committee?
Representative Hayden?
Madam Chair, I was made aware of it 5 minutes before the committee, and I thought if I went out to get them, I wouldn't make it back in the snowstorm.
So, Representative Root, the committee is officially taking a rain check on that, or a snow check. Okay. All right, Representative Thiessen, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Yeah, I move that House File 444 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Higher Ed Committee.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves that House File 444 be passed and recommended to pass and referred to the. Oh, it has to go to finance first. Referred to the Committee on Finance with
Does
a recommendation.
Really have to go there? And there's no fiscal note on it, but.
Well, okay, but higher ed is within finance.
Just because MC's referenced, that's the reason. Okay.
Okay, so it's recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Higher Education and Workforce Development Finance and Policy Division. Okay, Representative Thiessen. Now that we got that straight, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This actually doesn't have any fiscal impact because it's just changing our policy. So if we continue funding our suicide prevention grant, then this would just become part of the policy. So it doesn't add any money to the system. That question will be answered in Representative Huntley's
committee later on separately than this. But this is just, but even if the, that money kind of is diminished or anything happens to it, it we'll still have this policy in place. So I just want to make that clear as we're going forward here. And I'm just going to turn it over to the testifier to what we found is that one of the most difficult issues with areas with regard to mental illness is kids that are in college. And so this is trying to incorporate at least some focus on that as we go forward here.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathleen Kelso. I'm with the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll start out by saying that Minnesota's suicide rate has increased each year since 2000, making suicide a leading cause of violent death in Minnesota. And more than 90% of suicides are associated with diagnosable mental illness and or substance abuse. Of all age groups, persons 75 to 84 years of age have the highest suicide rate. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 34-year-olds, and in fact, 83 suicides occurred for teens and young adults aged 15 to 24 in 2006. The number of active duty soldiers who die as a result of suicide in 2008 exceeded the rate recorded in 2007, which was at an all-time high, according to the U.S. Army. And a lot of those soldiers will be coming back and going back to college. Minnesota recognized suicide as a leading cause of death and thus a serious public health concern when we funded the statewide suicide prevention plan, intended to reach across the lifespan 8 years ago. Since then, prevention funding has been reduced, then eliminated in 2005, and then funded again in 2007. The total amount now with the Department of Health budget is at $498,000 for community grants. The purpose of this bill is to just alert you to the fact that the suicide prevention plan is carried out through community programs, and that that we must recognize the critical need for prevention of suicide among the college-age students. The rise of suicide rates among youth and older adults reminds us to approach mental health from a public health perspective. That approach includes all people in Minnesota and involves working directly with individuals, communities, and systems. A public health approach promotes mental health across the lifespan, preventing illness or disability by providing health information to everyone. We explicitly add representatives from Minnesota State Colleges, universities, and the University of Minnesota in order to focus awareness and prevention efforts on college campuses and student health services statewide. It is not the intention to leave out private colleges, but to begin this dialogue with publicly financed higher education systems. I'm sure Minnesota colleges, University of Minnesota realize the need for suicide awareness prevention programs that address their diverse student population. And we know that some have taken steps, such as websites, that are intended to help students find help when depressed and suicidal. However, a suicidal person will need more support from within their immediate college, community college, than a web-based information system can provide. And before attempting suicide, and if prevented, they will need just as much support when recovering from that experience once they're back at school. And with that,
all right. Any questions for members? Okay, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. Having worked in higher education, I had several students that I had contact with who commit suicide during that time period. It's a fairly, unfortunately, common occurrence in college settings. My college-age daughter's best friend just last week at one of our men's views had one of their friends in a network commit suicide just as last week. So it is a very serious issue on college campuses throughout our country, and I'm very glad that you're extending it to this area.
Okay. Other questions, members? If not, Representative Thiessen, do you want to?
Yeah, I'd like to. I'm actually going to amend my motion. I think we should send this right to the floor, and I'll talk to Representative Rookamina. Hasn't requested it yet, so I'm going to talk to him. I don't know why we have to go just because they're referencing the chancellor. So. I'd like to amend my motion to that this be recommended, passed, and sent to the floor.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves that House File 444 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. There's no other discussion. We'll take a vote. Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The bill is passed and sent to the floor.
Thank you.
And members, we are adjourned. Thank you. Drive safely.